Detroit Symphony Orchestra, conducted there by Paul Paré, in the Suite Pastorale by Emmanuel Chabrier. And so this Radio 3 Sunday morning draws to a close. I do hope you've found it interesting, and thank you so much for listening. Next Sunday, James Jolly will be here with another Mozart Symphony, number 29, in a fine recording under Otto Klemperer. There'll also be an hour's worth of music from Finland by, among others, Sibelius, Palmgren, Rautavaara and Madatoya. Do have a great week, and join James, if you can, next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock, here on Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Jonathan Swain is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
In Words and Music this week,
I wandered, lonely as a cloud.
Actor Toby Jones walks the line between solitude and loneliness.
When all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils.
The writings of John Williams, George Herbert and John Clare are partnered with music from Hildegard of Bingen to Mozart to John Coltrane to explore the uncertain terrain of being comfortably alone or painfully abandoned.
Labour thy praise and my relief with care and courage building me till I reach heaven and much more thee.
Toby Jones, Alone with Words and Music, on the subject of solitude, this evening at 5:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And now, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest today is the poet-songwriter Michael Horowitz.
Michael Horowitz is one of the last surviving beatniks, the big daddy of the British beat movement. In the 1950s, he founded a groundbreaking magazine, which was the first to publish new work by Samuel Beckett and William Burroughs, including passages from Naked Lunch, which had been banned from obscenity in America. At 78, he's still performing his poems in pubs and still playing his Anglo saxophone, a very distinctive instrument that you invented, Michael. I'm glad to see you brought it with you today. Can you just describe it for us?
Yes, well, I saw this in a shop window, music shop, in about 1954, and it's basically a kazoo. It's been through probably many thousands of gigs. And the bell came off first, and then the bit between the diaphragm and the rest of the blue plastic. All that's left is this not very hygienic mouthpiece through which I will blow.
In the 50s, Michael, you were one of the leaders of a sort of poetic movement across Britain and America, a social revolution in some ways, and what we now call the beat generation. What did it involve being a beatnik?
The great big change came in the late 50s, early 60s, when more and more poets were presenting some sort of performance, reading aloud, because until then, poetry in Britain at least, was very much restricted to a game reserve of people, most of whom had degrees and knew Greek mythology and were from middle or upper class backgrounds. And gradually all of that changed because there were more and more potential poets realizing this wasn't a closed shop, only available to their supposed elders and betters. And so you had poets in Britain, in Edinburgh, Newcastle, Liverpool, notoriously, all over the country, not being ashamed of their regional accents, but in fact valuing the oral tradition. So you had a total revolution in form, and in America it was largely the beat poets, Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, gradually swept the boards of poetry wide open. And I also made a point, as others did, of bringing other arts into it, certainly jazz, folk music, dance, plays. We had a modern classical music director, whom I'm sure you know, of Cornelius Cardew, And then we introduced and published and met and worked with John Cage and Lamont Young. And so all of this wasn't only the Beat Generation. My friends and I weren't only beatniks. We were interested in a much wider spread of literature and the arts across Europe. And throughout the 1960s, this went from strength to strength.
Well, more on being a beatnik later. I think we can actually hear the Anglo saxophone and you in close harmony, as it were, playing The Tiger by William Blake with your band.
Yes, William Blake plays Matrix. Tiger burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? Could twist the sinews of thy heart, and when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain? In what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dead grasp? Dare its deadly terrors clasp? Stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears. Did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee?
Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry?
Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry?
Who actually wrote the music for that?
Well, I more or less did, although I can't read or write a note, but the others are brilliant at making dots of what I sing to them.
The Tiger, my guest today, Michael Horovitz, and his William Blake Close Matrix Band, with fellow musicians Madeline Solomon on flute, Peter Lehmer, piano, and Annie Whitehead, trombone. One of the things that you often do with music is to, as we heard there, intersperse poetry, but very often your own, on top of the music, half sung, half declaimed. And actually it occurred to me, I wonder whether that influenced people like Ian Dury and the Blockheads, because he did something rather similar, didn't he?
Oh, very much so. I had long conversations with Ian. We argued a lot because he insisted everything had to rhyme, and I said, look, that's rhyming is one way of shaping words. But he was very good at it. And he was highly literate and liked reading certain poets over and over.
He had a great hit with Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick, didn't he?
Yes, and the Reckless Eric songs and many brilliant lyrics.
You're the youngest of 10 children, German-Jewish refugees, and your mother, perhaps more importantly, played the violin, didn't she?
Yes, in her youth. She had had 10 children and several stillborn children. And so
goodness,
she didn't...
That's rather amazing.
Yes, she... Well, I think they took literally be fruitful and multiply and or didn't know of the existence of contraception or want to know.
Didn't leave a lot of time for violin playing.
Well, gradually the violin stayed unplayed by her. So one of my brothers took it up a bit. But the memory of playing and her love of music remained unquelled even into her last months. She died aged 108 months in 1995. And as the sing-songs on Friday evenings and Shabbat, the Sabbath day, and the festivals were big high spots of her life, and she would still join in and harmonise and love specific melodies.
So this music that we're going to hear next is really all about her. It's
yes.
Beethoven's Sonata. The Rondo from Beethoven's Violin Sonata No. 5, the Spring Sonata, and it was performed there by Itzhak Perlman and Vladimir Ashkenazy. One of the great things, Michael Horowitz, about Private Passions is that we really do try and play music in full and whole movements from longer works. And I know that that really matters to you, doesn't it? You've got quite a thing about music that's faded out on the radio.
Well, we seem to be in an era whose zeitgeist can't bear anything to take more than a few seconds before you switch channels or bring in some backing item. And because a lot of the other sounds, as when you switch on a computer, as well as the thing you're looking for, you get advertisements for penis enlargement and get a new kitchen, etc. It's very hard for an oldie like me to focus happily whilst either listening to the radio or looking at computer screens. You know, Shelley said poets are unacknowledged legislators of the world, and I would be about to get on a soapbox if your programme weren't concerned with higher things.
So I don't think anybody could ever accuse you of being sort of an old fogey, Michael. You're the very antithesis of that. Next, jazz, and the British jazz pianist Stan Tracy, who sadly died recently. And, of course, you knew him really quite well, Michael.
Yes, he was one of my best buddies. In the early 1960s, I was living in Soho, and my home from home was Ronnie Scott's First Club, a basement in Gerrard Street. And every night, Stan was the house pianist accompanying British and American maestros. So that was a kind of breeding ground for the younger musicians and poets.
Well, how would you epitomise Stan's qualities?
Well, there's so many. He was a very percussive piano player. He was a very, very witty, quietly, slyly humorous man, full of sardonic quips. His advice to a young musician said, "What can I expect in life as a jazz musician?" And Stan confidentially whispered in his ear, "Expect to be extremely rich." And that was typical of his irony. Meanwhile, I'm working on an elegy for Stan, and I'll just read a couple of excerpts from its current version. "The reach of his arms and mind and humours, fingers flying, pausing, pouncing with perfect pitch and timing, a magic wand that conjured poesy past rhyming, it flashed fresh colours in our ears."
And the piece you've actually chosen is, in fact, his take on the Thelonious Monk classic, Round Midnight, recorded when Stan was 80 at a live session at the Bull's Head pub in Barnes 6 years ago. two extraordinary minds brought together there, Thelonious Monk, his Round Midnight, and the pianist Stan Tracy. All the details, by the way, of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Going back to your parents, Michael Horovitz, we've already had a tribute to your mother and the violin, but your father was also musical. He sang, didn't he?
Yes, my father had a strong tenor voice and loved to sing Schubert Lieder and other German songs. And he also, when we were forced to flee Frankfurt and came to England, he soon picked up. He'd learned in a prisoner of war camp in France English a bit, and we'd hear in his slightly continental accented English things like, "Who is Sylvia? What is she that all the Sveins commend her?" And if we came in the room, he said, "Michael, what is Sveins? Sveins? Or fairest isle, all isles excel thee." And I, being the youngest, it fell to me to teach my older siblings and parents the finer points of English language and pronunciation. But he was a man who had, being a lawyer, especially in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, to be absolutely on his toes intellectually, and he was very kind of stood for high moral standing. And in a way, he bought the idea that being in Germany, having come from Eastern Europe, first to the Frankfurt ghetto, and then gradually his siblings and families built up. My grandfather, his father, was a kind of chief rabbi in Frankfurt, and he believed this idea that, not the master race, but the German tradition. He was hugely well read in Goethe and Schiller, and we had all those books, hundreds of them in every room of every house. They'd become assimilated, my network of families on both sides, and just couldn't believe this Nazi oppression could gain ground. Of course, it did alarmingly quickly. He'd gone on ahead to find somewhere we could live, spy out the land, and I'm told when the rest of our family, siblings, my mother came, my father met us at Victoria Station. I didn't realise what was happening. I was three, just three.
So this would be 1937
or 8, I think late 37. And apparently when I was just beginning to learn words, and I'd been told he'd gone to England. I didn't realise we'd come to England, and apparently greeted him when he picked me up and hugged me. "Aber Vater, du bist doch in England." "But Dad, you're supposed to be in England. What are you doing?" Assuming we'd just gone a nice, strange boat train journey somewhere else. So stories like that were handed down, and stories of my elder brothers being tied to trees and having stones thrown at them for being Jewish. I think the elders of the family tried to protect me from knowing. And indeed my father, of course, the more he heard about concentration camps and Roosevelt refusing to bomb the train lines to the camps and so on, the more he was busy trying to retrace. He worked very hard with other Jewish agencies and rabbis and lawyers all of his life to just either save or rehabilitate people who were in the dire straits the Nazis put them into.
So this music from Schubert's cycle, Schwanengesang, is for him.
Yes, he sang this, and he also loved to sing when Shabbat began, the Sabbath. All sorts of singing and music took place, and his versions of songs like this and Der Erlkönig, etc., by Schubert especially, were among his favourites to sing himself.
Leise fliehen meine Lieder durch die Nacht zu dir. In den Stillen einer Nieder, Liebchen, komm zu mir. Flüstern schlanke Wipfel rauschen in des Mondes Licht, in des Mondes Licht.
des Verräters feindlich lauschen fürchte Holde nicht, fürchte Holde nicht. Die Nachtigallen schlagen, ach, sie fliehen dich. Mit der Töne süßen Klagen fliehen sie für mich. Verstehen des Busens Sehnen, kennen Liebesschmerz, kennen Liebesschmerz. Rühre mit den Silbertönen jedes weiche Herz, jedes weiche.
Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing Schubert's Serenade, Ständchen. Gerald Moore was playing the piano. It was poetry that first really brought you to fame in 1965 when you appeared alongside Allen Ginsberg at the Albert Hall in the first international poetry incarnation. So, for younger listeners, what was all that about at the time?
Well, it wasn't the beginning of anything, but it was the coming together of many writer-performers, mainly poets, but also musicians, visual artists, came, flocked to Albert Hall. We announced it at just a week's notice. Luckily, it was a very beautiful summer's evening, and Allen Ginsberg had been on BBC television. I believe there was only one television station then in Britain, and trailed the event, and there were the three main beat poets, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Gregory Corso, and Allen himself. There was an Austrian sound poet, Ernst Jandl, and various British poets had been performing protest poetry, Adrian Mitchell, Christopher Logan, jazz poetry, Pete Brown, Tom McGrath, myself, and others. And there had very rarely been so many poets from different countries happy to give readings. And in fact, Pablo Neruda was invited and apparently said, no, Allen Ginsberg will take his clothes off, I will get in trouble. And the Russian, quite dissident and wonderful, sound poet in a way, Andrei Voznesensky, who did a lot, as did his mate Yevgeny Yevtushenko, to shake things up in the Soviet Union, he came to the event, he became friends with all of us, but he was forbidden by his apparatchiks. There were always minders following these poets from communist countries, from reading. Lawrence Ferlinghetti actually read variations on a poem he'd already called I Am Waiting, and included lines, I am waiting for our iron comrades to join us against the obscene boundaries imposed by the warring nations. So it was quite a strange coming together of spirits from many countries. I think it was 16 poets from 9 countries in the marathon event from something like 7 till 11:15, climaxed by Ernst Jandl, the Austrian who brought the house down with poems such as the German word for woman, Frau, which simply went fr, au, au, fr, 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 au, 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 fr, 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 and 8,000 people chimed in with him as he got going, Frau, au, 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 au. So he had a complete oral orgasm. Then he called Pete Brown and me up to perform Kurzschwitters' Fury of Sneezing, which again outlines an ordinary sneeze, you know, waiting for the moment and not coming again, very short, which again entertained the crowd. Hapaish, hapapaish, 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 hapapipi, 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 tcha! So things like that, in a spirit of euphoria, made a very lively party for 500 to 8,000 people. A lot were locked out. We couldn't believe these crowds as we approached the hall on the beautiful Friday evening. But our girlfriends had gone to Covent Garden and brought flowers. It was then the Flower. They got it on masses, and each person coming in was given flowers. So it was a strange, unprecedented event. I don't think they'd ever had poetry there before. The manager said he would never have it again because rude words were said and dope was smoked. But in fact, I don't think that capacity of a crowd, not that size matters that much, but the fact that I don't think that's been repeated since anywhere in Britain or possibly even Europe for just a marathon of poetry.
Well, a musician who was coming to the fore at that time was Ray Davies,
yeah,
and the Kinks. And this is a love song by him we're going to hear next, but not sung by him, but by Kirsty MacColl.
Indeed, yes. I think she does such a wonderful job and brings in these values we've been nurtured on from Bach chorales, etc., of multi-track self-harmonising, which I hope listeners will relish.
Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days, I won't forget a single day, believe me. I bless the light that lights on you, believe me. And though you're today could be tomorrow. The night is long, it just brings sorrow. Let it wait. Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days. You gave me, shines on you, believe me. And though you're gone, you're with me every single day, believe me. Yeah.
Kirsty MacColl with Thank You for the Days, a love song about memory. I rather liked the harmonising in that version. Your next choice is about love and, having just heard that song, rather appropriately, memory. It's a recording of your wife, the poet Frances Horowitz, reading one of her poems the same year she died, which was, I think, 1983.
I'm not even sure that she was aware she was completely under the cosh. She was diagnosed with cancer of the inner ear.
That's very unusual, yes.
Very savage irony that her ear for poetry and speaking and writing it, she was much in demand but by the BBC, among others, to always give readings because her voice was so exquisite, as you will hear. And this poem actually exemplifies the kind of Buddhism she came to in her the last decade of her much too short life.
This is called Rain. It's actually at Bird Oswald Fort. I stand under a leafless tree, more still in this mouse-pattering thrum of rain than cattle shifting in the field. It is more dark than light. A Chinese painter's brush of deepening grey moves in a subtle tide. The beasts are darker islands now. Wet, stained and silvered by the rain, they suffer night, marooned as still as stone or tree. We sense each other's quiet. Almost death could come, inevitable, unstrange as is this dusk and rain. And I should be no more myself than raindrops glimmering in last light on black ash buds, or night beasts in a winter field.
I love the mouse-pattering thrum of rain. It's a wonderful line.
Yes. Well, Frances's poetry is exemplary in her mastery of sound effects and all those S sounds giving you the feeling of the rain off the branches.
That was Frances Horowitz reading her poem Rain, Bird Oswald from a CD which is published by Bloodaxe Books alongside a collection of her poems. Home for you now, Michael Horowitz, means a flat in Notting Hill, which you described as a monumental chaos of manuscripts, boxes, plastic bags and books, worse than Miss Havisham's rooms. Is it actually almost a museum that you're creating there?
Well, it is a lamentable indoor skip. I've no pride in this. People keep wanting to photograph and film me in it, and I try to not parade my chaos. I do value chaos, but not to the extent that I'm proud of my indoor skip, and I am working at it and hope it will become less like Francis Bacon's studio and more like Versailles.
Well, now a real historical rarity. So this is, again, a trip down memory lane, because it's a jam session from 1945, which includes one of the few recordings, I think, of Charlie Parker's voice. It's led by Slim Gaylord, the American jazz singer and pianist, who, am I right, I thought I used to see him walking around Notting Hill.
You did. He spent his last 20 or more years mainly in London. They kept up his international connections. He had big families of friends, fellow musicians and children. They would have parties with non-stop music, and he would keep inventing in his personal argo the language of vaut, vaut-o-rooney, as you will hear. And this has long been one of my favourite 78s I had long ago, and it includes at least three of the musicians I would have liked otherwise to have separate recordings by, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and I think Slim introduces each of them in his inimitable way.
Can you give me a little example of what this sort of special jazz talk vout is?
Yabrach, Harisi, Jitty, Jitty, Butty. Mr. Valtorini, will you actually hear it? And usually it would be clear from the way he pitches it what he's driving at. He was short of one number for a recording session in, I think, Los Angeles. That, come on, Slim, we need one more. We've got another half hour here. Said, OK, let's see, what can we dream up here? And he looked out of the window and there were cement mixers doing what we see people do every day in the streets, renovating or mending something. And an example of his prowess as a sound technician is he instantly wrote the song Cement Mixer Putty Putty, Cement Mixer Putty Putty, and slammed on his guitar. But the great thing about what Slim Gaillard did with and without fellow musos is that it's self-evident what he's driving at, though unless you heard his recordings or performances, you would never have heard it before, but you would instantly become a believer if you're open to such beliefs.
Look here, here's a dodo on the piano and Tiny on the bass. Look like we'll have a fine jam session here. And here comes Zooty in the door with his brushes. And what's he know, Papa? Look at this cat here. Here's a suitcase there. That's scary. Beat on that one.
Oh, my door, Richie.
Well, look here. Well, here's Jack McVouty in his tenor.
Yes, indeed.
Well, say, Gates, how about blowing some, man?
Got the next call.
All right, that's great, man. Take it. You got it. Say, you better bring me a double order of Riti Vooties with a little hot sauce on it. That'll just about fix it. Oh, here's it. Well, look at Charlie Yardbird
O'Rooney. Hey, yes. Now, how's it going, Jim?
Oh, everything is mellow, man. Look at this cat get his horn with the neck.
Yeah, blow I've got
some?
My horn with me, man. I want to blow some, too. Yeah. I'm having a little reed trouble.
Haven't got a reed?
Yeah.
Well, McVouty's got a reed. He can trim it down a little. That's great.
Yeah,
well, that's
great.
Solid, then. Well, let's get together and blow. We in A flat. Take the next one. You got it.
Okay.
All right.
Slim's Jam, Slim Gaillard on guitar and vocals, with Dodo Mamarosa on piano, Zutty Singleton drumming, Jack McVeigh, or Jack Vouty McVeigh, I think we should say, on tenor saxophone, Charlie Parker alto sax, and Dizzy Gillespie trumpet. Well, that was jazz with words, and now to songs without words by Mendelssohn. And I think you have a quote by Mendelssohn that you'd like to share with us, Michael.
Yes, indeed. Well, Felix Mendelssohn, a composer whose works I've loved since childhood, is quoted in a biography. He was asked about why do you want to write songs without words, and he hesitated to attach a title, according to this biography, to these piano miniatures because he found words so ambiguous, so vague, so easily misunderstood in comparison to music, which fills the soul with a thousand things better than words.
Mendelssohn's Spring Song, the sixth song from his Songs Without Words, and played there by Walter Gieseking. Almost sentimental, but too good to be called sentimental in a sense.
Well, I've always been a bit shameless about not minding sentimentality. Well, the sentimentalities of my choice, I suppose.
But it's interesting how, as you say, you're a wordsmith and you've devoted your life to words, and yet in one sense music matters even more.
Oh, absolutely, and now in what's probably my last decade, it matters more than ever. They do say, don't they, you know, neurologists and so on, music and interest in sounds and rhythms long predates, you know, you asked my memories coming out of Germany. Well, that was three before I could even understand there was such a thing as language. I was probably rocking as I've watched my son rocking to Abbey Road, was then just out from the Beatles. But you could see, looking at him, aged just a few weeks and months in the cradle, digging what the Beatles were up to in one of their last recordings, and presumably it reaching him in quite as blissful a way as it did later on to us adults who had forgotten that. And then I believe they say this is the last thing that stays, even people with advanced Alzheimer's, etc., if one can be advanced in Alzheimer's, that music and sounds and rhythm again. Yeah, I know people who play music for patients of that sort of dementia and describe how the the people in the old folks' homes wake up and are delighted to dance and to nod and to respond to the music, even though they can hardly talk.
That's a rather nice note to end on. And thank you very much, Michael Horowitz, for bringing us your own very individual view and reactions to words and music. We're going to play you out with another one of your own recordings. And here you're performing a song poem alongside Damon Albarn and Paul Weller in The Ballad of the Nocturnal Commune. It's a piece that includes the lovely line, "The spaces of love truly felt now dissolve the far-gone years."
On the night that immemorial, cats set off as oft, bats bestrid the cavern, and the belfry toppled croft. Bats bestrid the cavern, and the belfry toppled croft. Now as voles they lay a-dying, and willow her brown swine, stars enveloped in mist now, owls turned over and sang. Stars enveloped in mist now, owls turned over and sang. Bodies curled, salt juice assuaged, blent souls in tender of kin. And as day breaks the shell of pale moon's waning egg, the glad lover sleep leapt in. And as day breaks the shell of pale moon's waning egg, the glad lover sleep leapt in. The evergreen lovers of leap year, they made love and they sang to sweet sleep. Stars cross lines with the sun now, owls turn over in sheep. Stars cross lines with the sun now, owls turn over in sheep. And silver blue cornflowers cluster, the ripening wheat germ hears. The spaces of love truly felt now dissolve the far-gone years. The spaces of love truly felt now dissolve the far-gone years. With the light of ancient springs to guide lost minds to cool ease in their glide. Jets of spring-powered joysticky seed-spinning planes take their leaves, leaving newborn refrains. Jets of spring-powered joysticky seed-spinning planes take their leaves, leaving newborn refrains. Dying leaf, blossom swirling, tail-spun lives drown their grief, leaving green-yellow stains. Dying leaf, blossom swirling, tail-spun lives drown their grief, leaving green-yellow stains. La 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 la. Oh. wings of song, purgatorial, gnats flitted off to loft, bird calls dappled the forest, and our love, the arboreal croft. On the wings of song, purgatorial, gnats flitted off to loft, bird calls dappled the forest, and our love, the arboreal croft. Bird calls dappled the forest, and our love, the arboreal croft.
Michael Barclay's guest was Michael Horovitz, and there he was accompanied by Damon Albarn, Graham Coxon and Paul Weller. All the details of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, where you can also find out how to download this programme and others in the series.
The Winter Olympics on the BBC.
It's time to see who'll shine.
A massive cheer. Is it a good start?
She's in gold medal position.
Half a second in the lead. That's a massive margin.
A seething, celebrating grandstand.
The last turn. Surely it's gold. Oh, yes!
The Winter Olympics continues today. Online on BBC Two and on BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's just gone 1 o'clock, and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. The Communities Secretary, Eric Pickles, has admitted that the government got it wrong by not dredging rivers in the flood-hit Somerset Levels. He said ministers may have been over-reliant on advice from the Environment Agency. He apologised unreservedly to those affected. The leader of the UK Independence Party, Nigel Farage, speaking on a visit to Somerset this morning, called for the government to pay compensation to flooded land and home owners. He also said a public inquiry should be set up to look into how British rivers are managed. South West Trains say direct services between Exeter and London have resumed. The line had been blocked by a landslide at Crewkerne. The acting leader of Exeter City Council has called for more government funding to improve rail lines. Barclays Bank is investigating claims that files containing confidential information on thousands of customers have been stolen and sold. The Mail on Sunday says the data includes passport and national insurance numbers, as well as money and health information. Votes are being counted in Switzerland in a referendum on whether to abandon an agreement with the EU on the free movement of people and reintroduce strict quotas for foreign workers. The first projection of the result suggests that 50% have voted in favour of quotas and the same number have voted against. A gunman has opened fire inside a cathedral on the Russian island of Sakhalin, killing a nun and a churchgoer. Six other people were wounded in the attack in the city of Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk off the country's Pacific coast. United Nations aid workers taking food and medicine into besieged areas of the Syrian city of Homs have again come under mortar fire. Yesterday, several members of the Syrian Red Crescent were injured. The snowboarder Jenny Jones has won Great Britain's first ever medal on snow at a Winter Olympics. She took bronze in the women's snowboard slope style at Sochi. And the weather, it'll remain windy this afternoon with severe gales across some southern parts. There'll be a mix of sunny spells and showers, some of which could be heavy. BBC News and weather at 4 minutes past one. And now here's Jonathan Swain with the lunchtime concert.
David, thank you very much. Yes, it's a concert with viola player Maxime Reisenhoff and pianist Fabio Bedini playing at Younger Hall in Glasgow as part of the 2013-14 St Andrews concert series. Schubert and Brahms on their programme. The Schubert is his Arpeggione sonata. And first of all, here Robert Schumann. His violin sonatas are late pieces, the first two of them from 1851, a productive time for Schumann. It was the year of his Rhenish Symphony and the Cello Concerto, among other things. And both the sonatas were written quickly, apparently in a mere 4 and 6 days respectively. Bach and Mozart would certainly have approved. And there is something in this first of the Schumann sonatas of the music just pouring out of him. Three movements in all, this first one marked with passionate expression.